I'm turning this evening to the book of Genesis, chapter 22 and verse 24. And this will be our starting point, and our subject is that of marital oneness. So Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." Now in our recent study of Colossians, we passed by the verses on husbands and wives, and I said we would return to that for a special study a little later, and we've come to that point now. These words are recorded about something that was taught to man before the fall, right at the outset of human history. "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother." Very strange when you consider, but there haven't been yet successive generations, and yet the human race is prepared for it. When that time comes, there'll be one feature to note, and that is that the next generation, the next husband and wife, will leave their parental union and bond and be independent from it. "Therefore shall a man leave the authority, the influence, the care, his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto." The Authorized Version, the King James translators, were searching for a word. The modern translators go for things like "shall be joined unto his wife" or "united to his wife." But the Hebrew is strangely stronger even than that. And the King James translators were onto something when they were clearly reaching out for something stronger. "Shall cleave unto." Very difficult term to translate. It refers to, the one shall be impinged upon the other. They'll be one flesh in every sense, and they'll merge in their lives. Joined isn't enough. United isn't really enough. It's strangely more. "Shall cleave unto." Perhaps that misses the mark a little, because it suggests more cling to than merge. But there's a level of unity which is difficult to express. And so there's another phrase added, "and they shall be one flesh," or it could be translated "one body," even. Not quite one substance, but certainly one body. So there's now equal care, equal concern. The one is not just concerned for him or for her, but there's equal concern, just as you would be concerned about every limb of your body. And if there was some disease or malfunction, you'd be concerned. It's your leg, it's your arm, it's your chest, whatever. Now, hers is yours, or his is yours also. One body, one flesh, one concern, care equally for both, interest equally in both, understanding equal for both, a great measure of oneness. One flesh, combined hearts and combined minds. And exclusively, she is yours, and you are his, and you're primarily for each other and not for anyone else. Now in the 90s, and some put their roots a little further back than this, but in the 1990s and some into the 1980s, there arose up in the United States, largely among groups of Bible believers, what came to be known as the patriarchy movement. And these were believers in their churches who thought, quite mistakenly, by faulty exegesis of the scripture, that the Bible meant far more emphasis to be given to the man than to the woman. And they misunderstood the scripture passages which say, man is for the worship of God and woman is for the support of the man in that. This is in the marriage relationship. And things were taken out of proportion and widely distorted. And the idea was, the man is everything. He is your Christ on earth to you if you're his wife. He has total authority over his family. He chooses his offspring's husbands and wives in future life. He does everything. He is all important. I won't characterize it correctly and entirely right now, but the patriarchy movement. It grew, and in the 90s, a few different groups came up. I think at the end of the 1990s, the most rapidly growing and perhaps the noisiest of them was Vision Forum, which was capsized around 2014 when the leader of that movement was found out to be a lifelong adulterer. Now, many of these groups weren't evangelical, actually. They're some of the biggest that exist now believe in baptismal regeneration and not personal evangelical conversion as we know it. So they're way off the rails, doctrinally, in some cases, and often that isn't known by people who are impressed by their teachings. But the patriarchy movement, it got into this country, but not so much in organizational form, just a few fellowships here and there. But it still managed to get into the churches. And in some of the churches, pastors began to teach this way. And so men only came out to the meetings. Their wives never came. Their wives were disproportionately subordinate in every sense. The patriarchy movement, really, it was little more or less than an opportunity for men to completely unbridle the sin of pride and express themselves and be bullies and be dominant in every way and autocratic. It really had appalling teachings, and some are better than others. The patriarchy movement. We're not talking about that when we talk in Christian circles about the husband being the head of the home. He is under God the head of the home, but not in a dominant way, not by virtue of the fact that he's intrinsically superior to a woman, not in an unsharing, uncaring way. And given opportunity, we'll talk a little more about that. But I wanted to say that from the outset, there is a very ugly distortion of biblical truth which gets about, which we reject. One flesh, it's against that. One flesh, heirs together. So much common understanding and sharing and drawing from each other. Now I'm going to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. This is a passage we often give a degree of attention to in wedding services, and from time to time when we're expounding 1 Corinthians, but it's the perfect passage from which to draw certain instructions and helps on marital oneness, on Christian marriage, because it doesn't cut out Christian men and women who are not married, but who are single going through life. Because everything that you read here, and every exhortation and every instruction, is equally applicable whether I'm living as a single person or a married person. Here are the rules for fellowship. We're going to particularly apply them in marriage, but they apply to all equally. So it's a particularly nice passage. to go through in connection with marriage, because it doesn't cut out those who are not married. It's the basis of all our fellowship duties and attitudes. And so I'd like to very simply go through some of the exhortations that we find in this passage. And as we do, I'm going to label each one positive or negative, because I've heard it said that 1 Corinthians 13 is a wonderful passage, but with regard to its instructions on love, it is so negative, people say. Well, actually it isn't. It is made up of 8 positives and 7 negatives, if you want the maths, and you can check up on me. It isn't entirely negative, and even the negatives are positive in a sense. But I thought I would refer to these as we go through. So, 1 Corinthians 13, chapter 1. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, in the days when there were tongue speakers, they were junior prophets. And here is the idea, the hypothetical idea of being able to speak in an angelic tongue. And even if you could, which you couldn't even then, and had not love. The King James translators chose charity because they could see that the context was outgoing love. Without love, sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal, worth nothing. Love is higher than any amount of good speech. You may speak very well of God, of the Word, of the Gospel. Without love, we're nothing. Love in marriage, love in the fellowship, one to another. Without love, your stock has crashed through the ground. We're worth nothing. And though I have the gift of prophecy, spiritual gifts, and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and had all faith, the gift of faith, the apostolic gift of faith, so that I could remove mountains. Without this love, it's above all gifts, all works, all knowledge. What are we like in our families? Good talkers, good understanding, ready knowledge of doctrine and all kinds of things. Without the practice of love, we're nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, however much self-denial is good. I have in my mind just at the moment a man. Years ago I would see him wheeling his wife in a wheelchair along the road every morning, and then back a little later, and when his wife went into a home because she had to be receive total care, he was there every day, so dutiful. Well, that's so good and so kind and so loyal. But even that, works of duty are nothing without love, with a hard heart. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and give my body to be burned, and have not love, it profiteth me nothing. So the passage opens with these three verses, that love is the highest aim in fellowship, in marriage, the bond of affection and unity. So now we come to practical matters in verse 4. What kind of love? Love suffereth long. Love is patient. It absorbs trials. Human nature is weak and spiteful and cries out and in some shape or form wants to lash out and blame the other. But love is patience. Can you measure love by our patience? It's patient. It yields to the tastes and the needs of the other. It listens and learns the viewpoint of the other. He may think differently and reason in a very efficient but a distinctive way. And when she speaks, she reasons in a rather different way. And he hasn't the patience to listen, because she doesn't go down his tram lines and follow his manner of reasoning things out. He's impatient and indifferent and brushes it off as inferior or meaningless. Love is patient. We learn what the other is saying and appreciate it and benefit from it. Love suffereth long. It is so patient and is kind, kind in expression. These are positives. It's gentle. It's sympathetic. It thinks of benefits that can be bestowed upon the husband or upon the wife. It's kindness in action, not just in sentiment, but it thinks of things. It's watchful and notices when things need to be done and things aren't right. Is kind. That's what kindness is. Kindness wants to make the other happy. Kindness doesn't wear a gloomy face because I've had a bad day and inflict that upon my wife or husband. Kindness says, I have a debt of making the other happy and lightening the gloom and cheering him up or cheering her up. That's kindness. We don't want to be convicted by these things so often, so we limit our definition of these words. Kindness, just an attitude. No, it includes all these things. Verse 4 still, love or charity envieth not. It's happy when the other has some great advantage which I don't have. This isn't a competition for attention or reward. It isn't jealous. It doesn't envy. You can't envy if we're talking about the fellowship, brothers or sisters in the Lord, who by the grace and providence of God are advanced in some way. We're happy for them. Thank God for them, for our husbands, for our wives. Don't let the shadow of envy ever flit across your sky. Love envieth not. That's a negative. Love vaunteth not itself. In other words, it doesn't assert its authority. This is distinctively about authority and its significance. I, that's the patriarchy movement, I am the significant one here because I am the man. It's just an excuse for male pride and domination. Love vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, it never boasts. It doesn't think it's always in the right. It's ready to be wrong and to not see things properly and to benefit from another perspective. Because there's love there. There's not only an affection for the other party, but there's a deep appreciation. God has given me one who is the bearer of help to me, and I must listen. That's the fourth verse. Look at verse 5. doth not behave itself unseemly. A hard word in the Greek to translate into English. Literally, if you were to translate the Greek in the most literal manner, you'd say, doth not behave itself in an unshapely way. That doesn't register much meaning in the English language. So often it's taken to mean in a shameful way. But that's going too far. It's not quite don't behave shamefully. It's don't behave shapelessly, inappropriately. So I'll tell you what this is about, verse 5. Doth not behave itself unseemly. It doesn't show no respect. It doesn't ever belittle the other party. It doesn't, especially in front of others, make flippant jokes about the other party or pull the leg of the other party in a manner which is going to diminish them and make them look foolish in the eyes of others. Doesn't do that. You cut that out completely. It is, in a way, in a mild sense of the word, shameless behavior, shapeless behavior, inappropriate behavior. It doesn't fit love or marriage or Christian fellowship. Come to that. Doth not behave itself unseemly. It isn't disloyal. It isn't ever tactless. It certainly isn't cruel. It doesn't treat husband and wife as property. That's all I would suggest under this intriguing term. And I think the King James translators have done the best that could be done with it. Doth not behave itself unseemly. And it kind of covers all those things. And yet we can think, oh no, I'm just being good humoured. I'm not being sarcastic or unpleasant or running down or belittling, but I am. And it does so much harm to love and affection and respect. So the things the apostle is inspired to give so much help to us here, that's a negative, but a very important one. And then I go down in verse 5 to seeketh not her own. Well, that's pretty obvious. Love doesn't seek its own way, its own pleasure, its own benefit, even though that may not be shared by husband or wife. It doesn't seek its own comfort, first and foremost. It doesn't seek her own at the expense of the other. It doesn't seek vindication. Some people do. Every argument, they must be vindicated. We can understand it from an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old, but for an adult, seeketh not her own vindication or anything. Then there's, halfway through verse 5, a very interesting negative, is not easily provoked. And the Greek term translated there, provoked, is the same word that we get our word paroxysms from. It doesn't fly off into angry temper and moods. Is not easily provoked. Some people can behave very foolishly, and because they're angry, they'll even call their marriage into question. And whether they love the other or not into question. Deep things, tremendous things, covenant commitments, lightly banded around. Our marriage will be over if you behave like that. What a thing to say. I didn't go to Malachi, but we could. Malachi chapter 2, marriage as a covenant, a solemn lifelong undertaking, is not easily provoked because a person cannot contain and control his disappointments or her disappointments. Childishly weak emotional muscles has to burst out in temper. And yet there's no need for that, because if there's anything which is controlled by prayer, it's a bad temper. Take it to the Lord in prayer. Over years and years, decades, I've been telling people, and they've looked at me with their eyes wide open, what should I do for my temper? Pray. Pray every day, and the Lord will help you overcome your temper. Pray. Don't I need counseling? Don't I need anger management? Don't I need some sophisticated technique? If you're a believer, pray with all your heart, and the Lord will help you control your temper. Is not easily provoked, how that can wreck love. And then at the end of verse 5, our time is racing on, thinketh no evil. Now that's interesting. What we say when we read it in the King James Version? You mean I have to be naive? I must never suspect anything is wrong. I must never think for a moment my husband or wife could be mistaken or in error or could have done a wrong thing. Well, it doesn't mean that. The Greek translated here, thinketh no evil, means something like this. Thinketh not upon the evil. That's literal. Now immediately you can see what it means. It doesn't keep a record of evil. That's the point of the phrase. It doesn't remember every wrong thing that was ever done. This is the person who cannot forgive and forget. She did something wrong. He did something wrong. It was all patched up. There was regret and repentance. So there should have been forgiveness and a putting away of the very memory of it. It should certainly not have been put in a file somewhere in the back of the mind, in a classified file, ready to be brought out against the other party at some time in the future. That's what it means. Love doesn't think upon the evil and record it and keep it alive. We're moving forward. We're being sanctified together. Thinketh no evil. And then down in verse 6, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth. There's a number of applications to this, but I'll just give you one obvious. Husbands, wives, Christian people in fellowship with one another generally, do not wallow in negative things like gossip or bad behavior by this one or that one. It may be necessary sometimes to refer to these things, but we don't enjoy it. And we don't go back to them and keep mulling them over. And by so doing, train each other to get a kind of perverse satisfaction or enjoyment from unpleasant and wrong and sinful things and gossip and so on. Why, you want a happy marriage. You want to be married to a wife who's an angel, a husband who's a saint, in every sense of the word. Then don't train each other with unpleasant talk, minimally. Because we have to be discerning and be warned about certain things minimally, but not as a habit and as a matter of pleasure. Think of some of these discernment ministries that are very common on the internet. And some of them, you may say, well, I suppose some of them may do an important job and warn us of this false teaching and that false teaching and all the rest of it. But I can tell you, one or two people who I've met and had conversations with who were involved in discernment ministries, but I don't wish to characterize all, but one or two that I've met have been very, very negative people. And they couldn't keep their noses out of it. And it was their breakfast, dinner and tea, as it were, every day. The unpleasant and the perverse. You try to have a pleasant conversation and in seconds it switched to some terrible scandal. Well, that's the warning here. Whether it's in our fellowship with each other, or it's whether it's husbands and wives. Rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth. And we want our conversation to be characterized by things that are uplifting and encouraging and helpful to us in the Christian walk. Well, time is slipping by. Look at verse 7. Love beareth all things. This is not so much talking about what we bear from each other, but that applies too. But what we bear together from the world. If he is made redundant, she doesn't immediately view him as though he's lost all his value. And now they've got to tighten their belts and it's his fault in some way. That may happen in the world. But as husbands and wives, we bear all things together and we hold each other up. And that's what it means. Beareth all things. Love holds hands tightly and is supportive in everything that may happen. And it takes and shares every burden, every forced separation, every illness, with great patience, beareth all things, believeth all things. And as one old commentator put it, it puts the best construction on everything. It isn't naive, but our first thought is to look for a good reason, if we can. Believeth all things, puts the best possible construction on everything. It isn't suspicious-minded and cynical. Hopeth all things. Of course, because we're praying Christians. And it's been a terrible disappointment or a terrible blow, but we brought it to the Lord in prayer. And we anticipate in his time, in his way, a wonderful deliverance. Hopeth all things, endureth all things. Love never fails, grows stronger and stronger. Every day, give thanks to God for your husband and mean it with all your heart. Give thanks to God for your wife and mean it with all your heart. Thank him and praise him for a lifelong partner. Give thanks to God for Christian friends in the fellowship and stand by them and with them. In marriage, potentiate the gifts of the other, not like those dreadful patriarchy people where the poor wife has to mind at home and never gets out to a Bible study or a prayer meeting, because he is the all-important one before God. That's terrible, that whole scene. Dear friends, quell pride. Talk to each other as often as you can. Potentiate the gifts of the other and make sure they're properly exercised for the Lord, for his cause, and for all the family. I didn't label each one positive, negative. You can do it for yourself. If you want a more theological study, and the questions answered, is it true or false that women must be weaker than men because Eve fell first? It's false. Do you want to know the reasons? And 101 other interesting theological questions? Well, I've tried to lay them all out, and they're online in an article entitled The Biblical Roles of Men and Women. You'll find it on the website. So if you want the biblical reasoning for each of these things, I would go there. But I've taken tonight to look at some of the inspired counsel via the Apostle Paul, particularly in 1 Corinthians 13.